Okay, so this is the final week in our movie/TV and Torah series. And what I'm going to do tonight, from what I've heard, is completely and totally different from what anyone else has done. I'll be honest, right? Most people who give shiurim on movies or TV and Torah. And from what I've heard, this has been the first three in the series, show a clip or an episode, and then they try to sort of connect some moral lessons from the movie, TV, to Torah, something like that. I'm not going to do that. No moral lessons, no nothing. Some people do that well. I don't do that well. I don't do the movie connecting to moral lessons thing well. What I do want to do is use the movie to illuminate the stories in Tanakh, because the truth is that any movie, making any movie, is an act of midrash. What I mean, it's an act of midrash, right? I've been giving a series at Beth Emeth in the weeks leading up to Pesach on Exodus in Hollywood. Where they are literally the movies that are made of Yetziat Mitzrayim are midrash, right? They're doing what midrash does. They're filling in narrative gaps. They're playing. They're imagining what a character in Tanakh looks like. And obviously, Lord of the Rings is not quite the same. Lord of the Rings is not of any story in Tanakh directly. But what I do want to do is use some clips from the movie to illuminate Tanakh. Narratively, not ethically, not morally, narratively. Now, what do I mean? So, if you know anything, okay, how many people have actually read the books or watched the movies? Either one is fine. Most. Okay. So J.R.R. Tolkien, right, the author of the books, was an interesting person. A classics major, also a deeply religious person. For people this means anything to, he was the one who was Mekarev C.S. Lewis, right, to Christianity, right? C.S. Lewis, who became a Christian writer, right, who wrote books on theology, mere Christianity and the like, became a devout Christian. He was Christian before, but a devout Christian through his friendship with Tolkien. And Tolkien was a deeply religious person. And he was asked at some point, is The Lord of the Rings, is it a religious work? Is it a Christian work, a biblical work? His answer was fascinating. So you look at number one. This is from letter 142 in the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien. And he said, Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, right? For him, obviously, he's Catholic. He said, unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision. Do you need me to turn on some of the backlights? Do we need to turn on the backlights? No? People can read? No? Okay, we're good. Okay. That is why I have not put in or have cut out practically all references to anything like religion, to cults or practices in the imaginary world. For the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism. Right? And he says something fascinating. He said he did not set out to write The Lord of the Rings as a religious allegory, as opposed to his dear friend C.S. Lewis, who wrote a seven-part, a fantasy allegory of the New Testament, which is, right, well, the Chronicles of Narnia, right, all seven of them, right, the most frontal of them, obviously, is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where the main character is the lion, who's the son of the Emperor Under the Sea, who dies for the sons of men and is resurrected, right, and belief in him brings you to the Narnia to come, right? If you don't catch the reference, then you don't know enough about Christian theology, but that's fine. Now the computer says, oh, no, we're good, okay. So C.S. Lewis set out to write an allegory about the New Testament in fantasy form. Tolkien did not. Tolkien set out to write, as he himself tells, mythology for England. Right? He felt England didn't have enough mythology, so he set out to write a mythic work, an epic mythic adventure. And that's why he has a three-volume work, plus the prologue, right? Meaning the three volumes of The Lord of the Rings, plus The Hobbit, plus all the other things that come along with it, the languages he wrote for it, the Cimmerillion, the history of it, all those types of things. He wrote an epic work. And when he wrote it, he did not imagine that it was religious. And then he read his own book, and he said, actually, it is. Meaning, and I think this is more powerful than what, in certain ways, than what Lewis did, when he reread the book, he realized that his influence, being a religious person, had permeated the very narrative. He hadn't realized that it was just sort of the natural thing to do. And when you read or watch The Lord of the Rings, what you see is that that is the case, that the sensibilities of it are very religious. Now, that's true in the theological level, right? In the sense that, and this is, if you look at, if you Google Bible and The Lord of the Rings, mostly what you'll get is Christian writers talking about how The Lord of the Rings, for people who haven't read it, but everyone's mostly read it, but right, the book is all of, the book and movie is all about the War of the Ring, where there's this ring of power that the evil Lord Sauron needs to conquer Middle Earth, and it is found and is in the possession of a hobbit, who is a half-sized person, a halfling, and he is now tasked with taking it to Mount Doom from the fires in which it was forged, because it can only be destroyed in the fires of Mount Doom. Okay, if you, again, if you didn't read the book, that's a bit complicated, but suffice it to say, it's a movie about good versus evil. Okay, it's good versus evil, ultimate good. On the side of good, you have the wizard, you have the elves, the high elves, whatever. So in that sense, it's a religious work. It's about good versus evil, about mythic good versus mythic evil, etc. But it's more than that. And that's what I want to focus on. Not that stuff, not the ethical stuff and the religious stuff, but the narrative. The narrative, I want to contend, helps illuminate the Bible in fascinating ways. And two, I just noted for you that if you want to understand how biblically influenced Tolkien is, if you look in the Journal of Inklings Studies, Inkling Studies, Volume 4, Issue 2, in October 2014, you will find a translation of the Book of Jonah written by Tolkien for the Jerusalem Bible. Right? We're not talking about someone who just had a cursory knowledge of Tanakh. We're talking about someone who was influenced by the narratives of Tanakh. So you shouldn't be surprised to see Tanakh in The Lord of the Rings. So here's what I want to do. Okay, I have this feeling that most people, even if they read Tanakh and they learn Tanakh, cannot, for the life of them, imagine Tanakh. They can't imagine Tanakh. Because we live in such a different world than the world of the Bible, the world of Tanakh, that we just don't identify with it. So, if I ask you, right, imagine a Navi. What does a Navi look like to you? What is the role of a Navi in Tanakh? What would you say?
What they look like or their role?
Role, what they look like. Imagine your Navi. Pick a person.
He's got a robe.
Robe, great.
Long beard.
Long beard.
Even long hair.
Long hair, great. What is his role? What does he do all day?
Teach.
Teach. What else?
Prophesize.
Prophesize, talk to God, right? That's what we think of, because we think that a Navi is basically a rabbi on religious steroids. Right? That's basically the way we think of a rabbi. But if you read Tanakh, that's not really the case. And if you want to understand what many Nevi'im, not all, there are different Nevi'im, we'll get to that in a second. If you want to understand several Nevi'im, especially the one I want to focus on, Shmuel, then if you've ever watched or read The Lord of the Rings, just understand that Shmuel is Gandalf. Right? The role of Navi is the role of wizard. What do I mean? So as we'll see, the role of Navi is not primarily to talk to God. It's to be God's political arm in the world and make sure things happen. That what God wants to happen in the world happens. And therefore, what does Shmuel do in Tanakh?
Appoints kings.
He appoints kings. And he takes away power from kings. Right? He's the balance of power. Right? You know, we have checks and balances in our government. In the time of Tanakh, the checks and balances was the king and the Navi and Sanhedrin. But the Navi is God's check on the king's power. It gives the king power and it takes it away. Right? He's also a warrior against evil. Right? right? Raise your hand if you can imagine, right? Kropotkin getting up there and cutting Agag, right? The evil king into quartering him, right? Taking his sword out and cutting, right? You can't, because that's not what rabbis do. It's not what I do, right? So But Shmuel, when Shaul fails to kill Agag, the king of Amalek, he goes and he kills him, right? With a whole story to boot, right? A whole speech. Shmuel is organizing the political structure of the government. He's getting wars going, right? With that God wants. But now let me push it farther, and this is why I think it's helpful to have movies and not just books, because I can say this to you, but here's what I have noticed. People read Tanakh, and if I tell you Shmuel is not a rabbi sitting in a base medrash, Shmuel is a political leader, a warrior, you will have cognitive dissonance, because you imagine a religious leader as I do, right? I tend to think of religious leaders as guys sitting in the base medrash or whatever, right? And yet you watch The Lord of the Rings, right? And all the discomfort you have with violence, and all the assumptions you have that a religious, ethical leader should spend his day studying and thinking about important things disappears because you identify suddenly with the wizard. You know that people should listen to him, should follow his political advice, should risk their lives and follow his test. Suddenly the movies get you to identify with a religious leader, essentially, right? As Tolkien says, he doesn't have to talk about religion because essentially this is a religion, right? The wizard is the voice of good in the world. And he's telling you to fight, and we identify with Gandalf. We identify with the wizard. But if we take a moment to realize that in Tanakh, Shmuel, the Navi, takes that same role, and we try to imagine Sefer Shmuel as a movie, right? As an epic fantasy, right? I mean, it's not a fantasy, but you know what I mean, right? Maybe we'll be able to identify with the greatness of Shmuel, but thinking about him the way he was, not the way we imagine religious leaders. And just again, another thought, the same is true of kings, right? David, who we think of as our king, and we, I think most people tend to identify him, right? They think of two things with David HaMelech, right? The first two things I think most people think of David HaMelech are Tehillim,
fighting wars.
Well, so I would have said Bathsheba, right? Most people, I think that's probably the first thing they think of, right? Building, not so much. It's Shlomo who builds the Beit HaMikdash. But the truth is, you're right, right? What do we know about David when he first comes on the scene? He is a warrior, right? He's a warrior. That's what he's known for. He kills Goliath. He kills Goliath. That's how he becomes king. Right? That's how he becomes king. He's praised, as we will see, for killing tens of thousands of people. That is his praise, right? And yet in our minds there's a cognitive dissonance, because how can a person who's known as a warrior killing 10,000 people be the person who gives us Tehillim? But then we watch The Lord of the Rings and you have no problem thinking of Aragorn, who's the lost king of Gondor, right, being a valiant warrior and singing these melodious elvish songs in the holy tongue of High Elvish, right, that you don't understand. Why? Because the movies are very good at getting at the ethos of Tanakh, but when we read the book, we impose ourselves on it, and we think, what does a religious leader look like in 2018? We don't identify with the narrative that the story's actually telling us. So what I want to do today is look at a few clips from Lord of the Rings. Someone asked me, I don't know why anyone would ask me this, are we going to watch all the whole movies? I don't understand, it's 12 hours long. No, in an hour, sure, we're not going to watch 12 hours.
Because Rabbi, the first two were TV shows, so we watched the whole episode.
I think you should watch them. Look, I will go on record as a rabbi telling you, you should go and watch them, right? But not in a 1 hour share. Take your 12 hours of TV time and spread it over as many weeks as you want. I'm not telling you to binge watch, right? But they're good movies, and I think that when you think about it from the perspective that we're going to try to develop, you actually will come to an appreciation of the biblical narratives in a way that we don't often have. Yeah?
But is it really that hard in the modern era where we can sit in a shiur in Israel and have teachers who are teaching Torah who are also soldiers, and they'll cross-reference, you know, you sit with Rav Maidan, and you'll sit and you'll talk about experiences he had before.
So you're right that I think people who have gone to Israel and really studied with those people or been in the army have an easier time. But living in North America, right, it's harder. I think you're right. I mean, we have a better sort of insight into this. But I still don't think it's as good as the movies, right? But that's what I want to focus on, right? So as I said, I don't want to do ethical lessons. What I want to do is try to get ourselves to the point where we can identify with the stories in Tanakh in the way that they were probably imagined, not imagined, the way they were visualized, right? The way they happened, and the way they would have been viewed from someone who lived in that world, because the movies managed to get us to identify with those characters that we can't seem to do when we read Tanakh, or we could if we just thought about it, right? But the movies make it much easier. So let's first start with three, okay? Just a source here. This is a very helpful article by Rabbi Yitzchak Et Shalom, where he notes that the role of Navi in Tanakh, the Navi, the prophet, has eight different roles. So some of them are those that we've mentioned, right? Communication with the divine, representative of the divine message, right? Like Avram, who goes out and teaches the world about monotheism. The messenger of God, like Moshe. The lawgiver, also Moshe, right? But then there's the court prophet, the political prophet, Shmuel. So he writes here, it might be argued that Shmuel ranks as the second most empowered prophet after Moshe. He is being listed with Moshe and Yirmiyahu and in Tehillim, with Moshe and Aaron. This supports this argument. Although it may be a bit premature to call him a court prophet, Shmuel is the first whose mission involves anointment of kings and whose destiny is to be a vehicle of change from prophetic, dynamic leadership to monarchic, dynastic government. Although Shmuel never serves formally anyone's court, he acts as Shaul's assumed superior. Like, this is what the Navi is. He has no appointed role, but he's the assumed superior to the king. Right? That he can take away the power of the king. No one gave him that power, but everyone just knows it. Right? It's just the ethos. He chastising for violating God's word, and twice announcing Shaul's demotion. First from the father of a dynasty, and then famously stripping him of the monarchy. He also serves in one famous scene as a sort of prophet for David when the latter flees to Ramah to seek Shmuel's protection from Shaul. David, however, is the first to have court prophets, right? It doesn't end with Shmuel. David has court prophets. He has God, and he has Natan in the famous scene where he sleeps with Bathsheba, and they come to chastise him, right? The king. Again, not appointed, but his trusted advisor to the king, the religious advisor. Now, he then notes, if you skipped a paragraph, he says a definition is an order. By court prophets, I mean someone who's employed by the court, whose job is to be an advisor to the king, and to borrow the biblical parlance, eat at the king's table. For purpose of our categorization scheme, we'll only include those court prophets who were, from the perspective of the text, proper and true prophets. And then he notes that after that, the next one is probably Shmaya, and then there's a lot of fake prophets who all serve this role, but not as sort of balance to the king, but as religious support to the king. And then he notes three other types of Navi are the charismatic, like Eliyahu and Elisha, right, who perform miracles and things like that. The independent non-court prophet, right, the outside of the court critic, right, the iconoclast, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Nevi'im Acharonim. And then there's the people's prophet who give them encouragement, right, really in the rebuilding period and stuff like that, like Malachi. Okay. Additionally, the prophet Shmuel is not only this political leader, sort of equivalent to the king, he also is at some level a king himself. Right? Now, where do I see this? You're looking for. So you hear, so the pasuk tells you, I'll say it outside and I'll just skip around a little bit here, but that Shmuel judges the Jewish people for his whole life. And every year he would go around the whole country. And anyone who watched the movies or reads the book, right? He would go around, he would visit different courts, he would go around the whole country, and he would live in Ramah. And as he got older, Vayasim et banav shoftim liYisrael, right? So this is Perek Chet, Pasuk Aleph, so two lines down. When he got old, he appointed his sons as judges. But the Jews came to him and said, we don't want your sons to be judges because, look, you're great, but your sons aren't so great. Right? Now, Shmuel is not happy about this. But what does that tell you? Shmuel assumed that what?
A dynasty.
A dynasty. Right? This is sort of the... I'm going to say this in 30 seconds, and if you've read Shmuel, you'll understand what I'm saying. Basically, Shmuel is always one step behind God's political plan for the Jewish people. Okay? By the end of Shoftim, there needs to be a king. Right? There needs to be a centralized leader. He's a centralized leader. Right? Shmuel is basically that centralized leader, but he's a Navi. But the people want a king. But he's not ready for it. Because God says, no, they're right. Listen to them. Give them a king. Then Shmuel says, okay, they'll have a king. It becomes Shaul. Shaul gets fired. And Shmuel stays up all night crying to God. And Hashem says, why are you still crying? I've already fired him. Right? Shmuel is consistently a step behind. God is always pulling him along, right, to the next political level. But he is, right, this transition figure who's always one step behind where the nation needs to be. And he constantly needs to be dragged along. That's the story of all of Shmuel. Okay? If that meant anything, great. But you think about it, right? Then he gives the speech. Right? God said, look, it's not you they hated, it's me. Shmuel said, don't have a king. We want a king. He gives it to them. But what you see is that Shmuel is at some level not just, right, a prophet, but the prophet himself serves in a certain way, the same way a king does. That's sort of the complexity. Right? He wants to be a dynastic leader, right? He at some level thinks he or could be a king. I just gave you one more thing here to prove sort of this, the way in which the prophets really are part of the royal court. I gave you, this was last week in the biblical archaeology review. They think they found a signet ring next to Chizkiyahu's ring of Yeshayahu Hanavi, which says on it, Yeshayahu Nun Beis Yud. Right? Right? Nin Beis Yud, and then there's something else. I'm not sure if an aleph was cut off. Right? Meaning Yeshayahu prophet. Right? Which they think is Yeshayahu Hanavi's ring, which they said, Navi is a profession. Right? That's what it shows you. Right? He writes it on his business card. Right? Yeshayahu Navi. Right? There's this role that he's serving. Right? It's next to Chizkiyahu's ring, and he has a ring. And, you know, in The Lord of the Rings, that's great, because Gandalf actually has a ring. It's invisible until the end of the book. He has one of the three elvish rings. Again, for people who actually watch that's actually not so much in the movie, but in the book it is. Fine. Okay. So now, to try to imagine it, with that introduction, let's look at some clips, okay? So we said, Shmuel, the prophet, is kingmaker. Right, as I said in 5, right? We can see here, I don't know how this renumbered, but whatever, this 5. V'ashem galad ozen Shmuel yom echad lefnei bo sho lemor, ka'ed machar shlach elecha ish, me'eretz binyamin, u'mishachto l'nagid al mi'israel bo shi'er ami, mi'ad plishtim k'ra'iti ami kiva tzakato alai. A lie, right? So he says, go, I'm going to appoint this person from Binyamin. He pours the oil on Shaul's head and says, God has made you rule over his people. And at the end of the movie, I didn't put this clip, but at the end of the movie, you see this exact moment where, what does Gandalf do? He puts the crown on Aragorn's head. He re-crowns the king of Gondor. But his job isn't just to anoint them on behalf of God. What else does he have to do? Convince the people to follow him. Right? Remember, he's political. He's not just pour it on and now you deal with it yourself. His job is to make him king. Right? He's God's political arm in the world. I put it to you in 6 here. Vahimi macharat, the next day, Mayasim Shaul. So the next day, Shaul divides up the troops. We're in the middle of a battle that Shaul has. They conquer them. There's no survivors left together. Fine. They say, where are the people who challenge Shaul's leadership? Give them to us and we'll kill them. No, we won't kill them. But what will we do? Let's go to Gilgal. Let us anoint the king. Right? He is responsible for it. And if you want to understand what this means, right, here. Okay, here's... Okay? In this scene, let me just get it. That. Why is it not doing this? In this scene, Gandalf, right? Great. Gandalf, for the first time, is bringing Pippin to meet Denethor. Now, Denethor is the steward to the King of Gondor, meaning the King of Gondor, the line of Gondor, has been lost. So instead of a king, they have a steward, meaning someone who holds, who ostensibly holds... What is going on here? Who holds the throne on behalf of the king. Okay? Right? So he's supposed to be waiting for the king, sort of messianically. Okay? Why is this not playing? Oh, seriously. Why is this not working? See, I even came in early, cracked, made sure it was working, and now it's freezing.
Do you want the light back on? Will that help?
No. Let's try. Just try it again. It is thinking. I don't want it to think too much, but I just want it to go.
You open it in the VLC?
That's what I'm going to try to do, but it's freezing, so it's... Task manager. There's no running apps. Yeah, I know that. Okay, I'm going to wait for that to work.
It's coming from the USB, isn't it? Not the phone.
Yeah, it's coming from the USB. Yeah. Okay, just while we're waiting, just if you look at 7, this is the story I've already sort of mentioned, but will become important in this moment as well. That Shmuel, famously, when it comes to when Shaul makes the mistake, right, he doesn't kill Agag, and he doesn't kill the animals of Amalek. So Shmuel takes responsibility, chastises him, and removes him. Right, this is his job, right, to give the king power when God wants him to have power, to lead him on the moral path that he's supposed to be on, and when he doesn't do what he's supposed to remove him, right? This is the role of Navi. Ah, come on, seriously. We're just going to do it this way. I'm going to go straight to YouTube. Okay, so this is when he goes and he meets Denethor with Pippin. Okay, here.
I come with tidings in this dark hour and with counsel. Perhaps you come to explain this.
Okay, so his son has been killed, Boromir. Fine.
Perhaps you come to tell me why my son is dead.
He had died to save us. In payment of this debt.
Escape, and my son did not. So my...
By one arrow.
Yeah.
There will be a time to grieve for Boromir. But it is not now. War is coming. The enemy is on your doorstep. As steward, you're charged with the defense of this city. Where are Gondor's armies? You still have friends. You are not alone in this fight. Send word to Theoden of Rohan. Light the beacons.
You think you are wise, Mithrandir. Yet for all your subtleties, you have not wisdom. Do you think the eyes of the White Tower are blind? I have seen more than you know. With your left hand, you would use me as a shield against Mordor. And with your right, you would seek to supplant me. I know who riots with Theoden of Rohan. Oh, yes. Word has reached my ears of this Aragorn, son of Arathorn. And I tell you now, I will not bow to this ranger from the north. Last of a ragged house, long bereft of lordship.
Authority is not given to you to deny the return of the king, the steward.
Rule of Gondor is mine, and no others.
All has turned to vain ambition.
Okay, so, in that scene... Oh, don't go to the next one. Stop, 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 stop. Okay, cancel. There we go. No, stop. Okay. Okay, so in that scene, right, what you see is... What do you see him doing? And tell me, what are the emotions you feel, right? What are the emotions you feel? Do you identify with Gandalf? Do you feel his moral authority to tell the acting ruler that he is going to lose his throne? Right, but it's still his responsibility to fight the war. Right? He's not appointed, but you feel his moral authority, right, to come to the acting king of Gondor and tell him, but you won't be king, because the authority isn't really yours. Right? That's Anuvi, that's Shmuel. Right? He comes, he commands the king, he tells the king, you have a responsibility to fight a war. Here's what you're going to do. This is how you're going to get an army together. Which other Nevi'im do this? Think in Danach. Dvora to Barak. God has chosen you to be the general. Go, get an alliance together. Right? Get an alliance together. And then in her song, we think, oh, she has a song. What does she say in her song? She yells and insults the Shvatim, the tribes who don't come to fight, and praises the ones who come to fight. And she's the person who chooses the leader. She gets people to fight, right? It's bloody, it's dirty, but that's her role. And here, right, that's what Gandalf does, right? He tells him, fight the wars. He tells him, you no longer have the right to be king. Now, if you want to see the Tanakh here, what happens when, as Denethor believes that he's going to lose his... He's not actually king, he's steward, but lose his rule of Gondor. How would you describe Denethor at that moment? Right, you saw him, the drool coming out of his mouth. Anger, more than anger. It's more than rage. It's madness. Right, and in a later scene, he's so upset that what does he do? Right, I didn't put this scene, but what does he do later in it? If you want, I can pull it up. Right, what does he do? People know the movie.
He surrenders.
No, well, he surrenders, and what does he do?
In addition to this pressure, I would say additional pressure from his son being knocked down.
For his son being knocked down, but what does he do? How does he die?
He
lights himself on fire, and he tries to... light his other son on fire as well, Faramir. He's lost his mind. Right? Does that sound familiar to anybody? Yeah, Shaul, right here. Jump to 10, right? What happens as soon as he finds out? Shaul finds out he's losing his kingship. 10. Vatihi ruach Adonai ra'a al el Shaul. God has an evil spirit take over him, madness. And he tries to kill David with a spear. And that madness extends. Because what happens when his son tries to stand up for David and say that David did nothing against him? Right? Look at 11. Why should he die? What did he do? So he turns the spear and he tries to kill his son, Yonatan. Right? Losing power, even if it's legitimate, drives you mad. Right? That's the picture. You want to know what Shaul looks like? It's that. Right? It's exactly that. Right? If you want, I can pull up this scene. Right? But here. Denethor burning Faramir. There you go. I'm just going to do it this way. Right? It's called Denethor's Madness. Right? No, wrong one. This one. Here. Right? He's pouring oil on himself to light himself on fire. Here he is on fire. Right? Here he is covered in oil. At the bottom, he's telling his people to light him on fire. And who tries to save him?
You may triumph in the field of battle for a day. But against the power that has risen in the east, there is no victory.
And there's his son, Faramir, in the fire with him, right? And then, who actually brings about the end, right? Right, so you see, right, the images. If you want to imagine what it looks like for someone to lose his mind because he, for a long time, had acted as the legitimate king, right? The steward of Gondor deserved to be, not king, steward, okay, acting ruler. But then he finds out that he's losing his right to be king and the madness that takes over him and that it drives him against his own family. Right, you want to know what that looks like? Right, this is what it looks like. And who is responsible for it? The Navi, or in this case, the wizard. Right, you want to know what it's like to feel the grandeur, the moral power of someone, not in a moment of religious teaching and divining with, you know, communing with the divine, but in battle, when getting your hands dirty? Imagine the character of the wizard, of Gandalf. Other things that are worth understanding. As I said, right, certain things that are very hard to understand for us. The valoration of death, of murder. Well, not murder, of killing. Right? It's hard, right? We don't understand it. We have trouble understanding it, right? And if you skip to 14, this is what I quoted before. Vatanena Nashim Hamisachkov Vatomar Hikashaul Balafa Vidavid Birivotav. Right, the women used to sing and say, oh, it's amazing that Shaul killed thousands and David killed tens of thousands. But, here, Legolas kills. Right, and we think that it's brutal. But if you think about it, what is the ethos of Tanakh? That many of the battles aren't just you're fighting for survival, but you're fighting evil. Right? The king is fighting God's war. Right? It's a good thing. Right? We may not want war in an ideal world, but when you have to fight and you actually have enemies coming against you and they are evil, right? There's something moral about killing.
Final count, 42.
This is a...
Oh, that's not bad for a pointy-eared elvish princeling. I myself am sitting pretty on 43.
43.
He was already dead.
He was twitching.
He was twitching? Because he's got my axe embedded in his nervous system!
Right. Now that's a bit of a funny scene, but what does it play on? Right, that, you know, at some level you identify with them. Why are we able to identify with Legolas and Gimli, but we're not with David killed 10,000? Because we don't imagine the enemies, right? In the movie it's very easy, they're orcs, right? They don't look human. But if you want to understand how you could valorize, it's not that we love war, but if you realize that people are actually fighting for their lives and their enemies aren't just, you know, are actually killing them or taking away their food or making their lives miserable or evil, you understand why there's a certain level of valoration of military strength. It's seen as a good thing. It's seen as a reason to, right, to appoint somebody king that he is able to fight. And this carries over not only to a certain identification with those who are militarily successful, even carries over to the tools of war. The tools of war are become inherently important. Right? When does this happen in Tanakh? David, again. Right? We're mostly in David and Shaul and Shmuel here. Right? David is running away from Shaul. And what does he do? What city does he reach first? Anyone remember? Nov. Right? Nov. The Ir HaKohanim, the priestly city. And he asks them for two things. Food and a sword. And what do they say to him? 15. Vayomer David l'Achimelech, ve'ein yeshvo tachad yadecha chanid, o cherev, ki im charbi v'gam keli lo lakachi v'adika, yad v'ar melech nachutz. Do you have any... Right, he isn't telling them that he's running away from Shaul. So he says, I was on a mission from the king. But do you have any weapons? I don't have any on me. Vayomer kohen, cherev goliad ha-plishti, asher hikita be'im ekaila, hine hi lutavisa... Masimla achareya afod, imotati kach lakach kach, ki in acheret zulata bazeh. Right, and he says, I have one sword. Your sword, the sword you used, meaning Goliath's sword that you used to cut off his head. Vayomer David, ein kamoa, tenenali. He says, there is no sword like it. Give it to me. Right, the sword itself has a history. And it is the first thing you hear about David when he leaves Shaul's house is what? That he takes a symbolic sword. And that's what gives him the confidence to be the warrior and to become the king he needs to be.
Doesn't he say just the opposite to Goliath? That I'm not coming with weapons, I'm coming...
Correct. But later on, right, he comes in the name of God. But later on, right, it is that sword, that symbol of his strength and his victory that gives him the confidence, right? He said, oh, there's nothing like it, right? That's what gives him the strength and he's running away. On that note, right, here... So what's going to happen here is Aragorn, who is the king, right? The king who has not yet been anointed to the king of Gondor, is in the middle of battle, and at that time, the highest of the elves, Elrond, Lord Elrond, comes to him in secret, and this is what happens. Okay? And the elves, if you don't realize, basically fit the role of Kohanim, right? They're spiritual leaders. They sort of sing the praises of God. That's what they do.
I come on behalf of one whom I love. Arwen is dying. She will not long survive the evil that now spreads from Morgoth. The light of the even star is failing. As Sauron's power grows, her strength wanes. Arwen's life is now tied to the fate of the ring. The shadow is upon us, Aragorn. the end has come. It will not be our end, but his. You ride to war, but not to victory. Sauron's armies march on Minas Tirith, as you know, but in secret he sends another force which will attack from the river. A fleet of Corsair ships sails from the south. They'll be in the city in 2 days. You're outnumbered, Aragorn. You need more men.
There are none.
There are those who dwell in the mountain.
So this scene, right, which is a powerful scene, right, in the movie, right, Aragorn doesn't yet have the courage to, right, to take the dangerous path that he needs to do to help win the victory, to be, as he said, the king you, right, the king you were born to be. And what gives him the strength? The elf, right, the Lord Elrond, who is this religious leader, comes to him and says, "Here's the sword." Right? Now the sword, a bit of background, is the sword that was used by his great-great-great-great-grandfather to cut the ring of power off the hand of Lord Sauron, which originally helped them defeat Sauron the first time, and now he's going to use to fight a second time. Right? And simply having that religious leader hand him that symbolic sword, remind him of, in this case, his ancestors' deeds of greatness, gives him the courage to be the king he was meant to be. Right? That's what happens in Tanakh. Right? For all that we don't understand it, right? He comes to know of Ir HaKohanim, the city of priests, of religious leaders, and he's handed the sword, and it gives him the courage. Ein kmotah, there's no greater sword. Right? And that gives him the ability to get an army, right? To become king. Right, if you want to imagine, right, when you read the story, I don't have the emotions pulsing through me that I do when I watch this, right, with the music and with everything there. But if you want to understand, right, you want to get into the mood of Shmuel and understand what does it mean to have a religious leader who isn't primarily sitting in the yeshiva, but is making kings, taking away their power, criticizing them, giving courage, right? What does it mean to have a king, a religious king, who on the one hand is known for Tehillim, but is also known as a warrior, right? And that's what he's known as, that's his courage, and that you identify with the morality of his, right, of his kingship. Imagine the movie. Why isn't when we watch the movie, we can identify with the battle scenes, we can identify with the power of the sword, we can identify with the religious value of a political leader like the wizard. But when we read Tanakh, we can't. And part of it is because we don't grow up in that culture. But if you read Tanakh enough and you try to get into the mind of Tanakh, as Tolkien says about himself, you may not set out to write a biblical work, but on second thought, of course it is. Right? This is the world, right, where being religious is so much more complex, right? Where you have to be involved in politics. Things are dirty. Sometimes it means killing. Sometimes it means battle, right? Sometimes it means, and that there is this complexity. There's a moral fiber to the political, to the military structure. And that's something that I think watching some, you know, a movie like this helps you imagine. Now, something else that helps you imagine is the is this notion, which we're really not comfortable with, right? But often, of a dynasty, of an inherent sanctity to the dynasty. So in this scene, right, what's happening? Why is he the king? Right? Why is Aragorn the king? So he's many generations since the last acting king of Gondor. Okay, he's many generations. Why is he deserved to be king? Because there's a sanctity to the line of kings, right? The kings of Gondor. That inherently breeds him for greatness. He needs to live up to that legacy. Not because of anything he did, but because his line is chosen. Which line is that in Tanakh?
David.
Yeah, that's David, right? The best example of this is in 16... where you have, this is Malachim Bet, the story of Ataliah. Right? Ataliah is the mother of the king, and she takes over. She kills everybody, every member of the king's family, because she wants to be queen. But what happens? Okay, it's dark, so I'm gonna summarize it out here. But what happens? Yosheva bar HaMelech Yoram achor Achaziah et Yoash ben Achaziah v'tignovo to mitoch v'nei HaMelech HaMuvmatim. They save Yoash, who's the king of Achaziah, being the rightful heir to the throne, and they hide him. And where do they put him? In Gimel, v'hi ita beit Hashem mitchabei sheish shanim. They put him there until for 6 years. He's an infant for 6 years. U'vashana shviit Shalach Yehoyada vayikach et sarei hameot lekarev la'artzim vayevei otam elav beit Hashem vayechor lehem brit vayishba otam beit Hashem vayartam et ben HaMelech. He gathers the army together in the Beis HaMikdash and shows them the six-year-old king, right? And then he makes them swear, and he says, this is what I want you to do. He gives them the whole military structure to protect them, right? Surround the king, three levels. And then in Yud Bet, after he's protected the king, Vayotzeyet ben HaMelech Vayitein alav et HaNezer Vayidu v'amlicho oto v'amshacheu v'yaku chaf v'yamru yichi HaMelech. They take the 6-year-old child and they put the crown on his head and they anoint him, they give him the Eidu, they give him the Torah, and they make him king, and they say, long live the king. And then Ataliah hears and she says, Kesher, Kesher, it's rebellion. And what do you have again? You have this, what does he deserve? Why does he deserve to be king? Because?
Lineage.
Because lineage is Beit David, and God made a promise to David. There will always be a king from Beit David. And therefore, he's a 6-year-old. He was saved as an infant. But the army is ready to fight for him. Right? The priests are ready to die for him. And he, at 6 years old, manages to rally the troops by his very existence against the evil queen, against Ataliah. Because there's a recognition that at some level it's above us. Right? There's a dynasty. God made a decision and there's nothing we can do about it. And if you want a scene which brings many of these things together, right? The power of the king, right? The moral power of the king. His ability to give morale simply by his very presence and his existence. The role of Navi The role of the Navi as the warrior and political leader. Right? Sort of the best scene in the movies. Anyone who knows the movies, if you can guess which scene this is. I really want the whole one. Let's see if this is it. Here. I think.
Right out with me.
So here, right? Aragorn, he remembers a prophecy, right? He remembers a message from Gandalf, which is, on the third day, look to the east and I will come. Which is, by the way, what? Who said to who? Shmuel said to Shaul, on the seventh day, wait for me, right? Wait for me in the battle, right? And now he musters the power of the other king of Theoden to ride, right? Even when it's seemingly certain death, right? But he convinces him to ride. Okay, so this is Aragorn. The next king is Theoden, right? And then you'll see when Gandalf comes in. If you want to see all the elements come together.
Ride out and meet them. For death and glory. For Rohan. For your people.
The sun is rising. Look to my coming at first light on the fifth day. At dawn, look to the east.
Yes. The horn of Helm Hammerhand shall sound in the deep one last time. Yes! Let this be the hour when we draw swords together. Fell deeds awake.
Now for wrath.
Okay, so to sort of wrap it up, right, what I think, right, what do you see in this scene? Right, in this scene, you see, right, everything coming together, right? What gives the people the courage? They're facing 10,000 enemies. What gives them the courage of a few men to go out and fight? The presence of their king. Right? Another story, you would see this in Tanakh, he's not exactly a king, but that's a bit more complex, is Gideon. Right? First, he has 32,000 soldiers to fight the enemy, and God says, too many. So he sends 22,000 home. Right, then he has a trick with the water, another 10,000 go home. How many people in the end does he have to fight the enemy? 300. And what do they yell as they go to war? La Hashem v'la Gidon, right? For God and for Gidon. And that's what allows 300 people to defeat an army, not the 32,000. Right? But when you read these stories in Tanakh, right? At least I usually have a hard time identifying with them, right? With really internal, you want to just turn on the light? I think I'm done with clips here because we're out of time, right? I have trouble identifying, right? What does it look like? What does a world look like where a religious leader isn't necessarily primarily the guy who gives shir and drashot or goes to shiva houses and funerals and helps and marriages and does pastoral counseling, but is the person in charge of politics, the person who chooses the king, right? What is it like in a world where to be a leader means sometimes you get your hands dirty and people understand they're under threat and they... No, they don't valorize war, but they recognize the real threat and those who can lead them through it and are also animated by religious spirit. What does it look like when that person's your religious leader? Right? What does it look like in a world where therefore even the symbols of war at some level, right, are significant or religiously significant? What does it mean in a world where that you have a where you have people who deserve to be leaders simply by dint of their birth, because it's a recognition that there's something beyond us, right? That my lineage requires me to do something, right? I have to live up to my lineage, not just make my own legacy, but I have a legacy that is waiting for me to take hold of, right? When we watch the movie, all those things become clear. We're okay with the wizard. We feel the moral power of him, right? When we see Denethor saying, you know, no one will ever be king, and Gandalf says, it's not up to you, steward of Gondor, to deny the rightful king his throne. Right? We feel the moral power of the wizard. Right? We understand. Somehow, the movie has gotten us to be convinced that Aragorn deserves to be king just because great-great-great-great-grandfather was king. Right? We all feel that moment of pride when he takes the sword, right, Anduril, the flame of the West, which is important because it did a fell deed in the past, and that makes him be the king he's supposed to be. This last scene, right? We feel why it would be that a king could get people to do things they didn't think they could do. What it means for a king who's the ruler to still be subservient to the wizard. Right, to say, wait, I told you till day 3, day 5, look to the east and I'll come. Right, and he does, and that gives him confidence because he's listening to the religious leader. And when they come together, right, there's that climactic moment. I sort of, you know, imagine this of like, you know, a messianic time, right, of like Melech HaMashiach on the horse saying, Mi LaHashem Eli, right, Melchemet LaHashem Bamalek Midor Dor, or something like that, right, screaming that we have a final battle, right, to reinstate... When you think through Tanakh, it's not just what we know. The world of Tanakh is so much more complex, right, and so different. But what I find about the movies is that if we realize that The Lord of the Rings, or movies like this, are in certain ways channeling the epic nature of the tales in Tanakh, it might give us a way to feel it ourselves when we read the stories. Because we can imagine, right, we cannot have, you know, we can try the same way in the movies. We lose ourselves in the movie clips, right? We can feel those emotions pulsing. We can feel the greatness of the moment. We can feel the power of the moment. If we use those emotions and we channel them and imagine, yeah, you know, that's Shmuel, right? The way, right, it's amazing that Shmuel, right, he looks like an old rabbi, right? But he's riding on a horse and he's leading them to battle. Right, that's what Shmuel looks like when he comes to Agag and says, right, and Shaul didn't kill him, and he goes and he kills Agag. Right, that's what it looks like, a religious leader, right, with the white beard and everything, but fighting a battle for the good, for the right, for God. So, like I said, what I was going to do today was nothing to do with moral lessons, right? I think that in many ways, one of the things that movies can do for us, right, is that movies are, especially award-winning movies, right, that win, whatever, 13 nominations and win all of them, or whatever it is, right? Good movies, with the music and the images and everything, they manage to get us into an emotional state, an emotional place that we sometimes can't get to when we read. But you realize that the excitement, the power, the complexity of Tanakh, right, is this level of excitement. Is this level of complexity. And in many ways, this is a reflection of that type of story. And we think about, right, these scenes. When reading Tanakh, I think we can, in a different way, put ourselves in that moment. Right? Feel what it means to identify with David, with Shmuel, to believe in the power of a Davidic line, the power of a Navi, the power of a military king. Right? The complexity. right? I mean, I didn't, you know, we can go through other clips, right, where Aragorn is also singing songs. And somehow in the movie, we don't see a contradiction, right? He can sing the elvish songs, but he can also be a warrior, because we recognize that that complexity can exist, because the movie manages to do it. In our heads, there's a dissonance, but when we watch movies, there isn't, because we know how to suspend reality and live in the movie. But we don't know how to do that with Tanakh. We don't know how to say the world of Tanakh 3,500 years ago is very different than the world we live in. But if we can take the movies to get ourselves in that emotional state, right, to lose ourselves in the story, to feel what the religious experience was like of Tanakh, and even if it's very different than ours, right, then we'll be able to identify with it more. We'll understand the power of that moment, what is trying to get across, and we'll understand what's actually happening in the stories. So for me, that's what I sort of use movies for, right? Is to get myself in a different emotional state, imagine what things look like in the stories of Tanakh that aren't part of my experience, but movies are very good at sort of getting at, especially when you realize, as in this case, Tolkien is a religious figure and those types of images are animating him. He's just very good at writing it, and you know, Peter Jackson's really good at putting it on screen to get us into that to that state. So that's what I have to say about the Lord of the Rings. I only went 5 minutes over time. It's not so bad from what I heard with some of the others, but yeah, but that was technical difficulties. Not my fault.
Being very irritated with this, if we watch the Ten Commandments. Oh, the Ten Commandments. But I mean, the Ten Commandments does that too. It's very epic, and it's. Very
I'm a big fan of the Ten Commandments, having just watched it to prepare this series at Beth MF. No, I think it's good. I think it's good. In fact, I think
it's a very different perspective than what I remember our teachers.
If you have 3 hours and 39 minutes, I would suggest watch. I would say it would be a worthwhile thing to watch the Ten Commandments, but to think about the midrashic moves it's making, because in the prologue to the Ten Commandments, right, they actually say that there's a lot of gaps in the story, and they draw on Philo and Josephus and Midrash, honestly, to fill in the gaps. Right? But imagine what it looks like. Everyone can go. Right? But I'll give you one example. Right? Last week, when I gave Shear, right, I showed them the scene from the Ten Commandments where Moshe comes to Paro and turns the stick into the snake. Right? And at first, everyone's scared. And then Paro's magicians recreate it. And then his son comes and kicks Moshe's stick, and everyone laughs. Right, and Moshe walks out humiliated. Right, when you read the text, right, what do you feel? Right, when I feel, at least when I usually read the text, I feel like Moshe brings a test. It's replicated. Okay, we're at zero again. You watch the movie and you realize you're not at zero again. You're at negative, because by being able to recreate it, everyone just makes fun of him and they dig their heels in more. And the truth is, the Midrash says that explicitly. Right, the Midrash says that Paro says to Moshe, "Why did you come here? Why'd you bring magic to Egypt? Big deal, you brought magic to Egypt. You don't bring fish to Akko, right, which is a seaside town. You don't bring magic to Egypt." And then his magicians do it, right? And then he calls his wife, and his wife turns a stick into a serpent, and then he calls the 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds, and they turn the sticks into serpents, right? And what is the Midrash getting at? That it's not zero, it's negative, right? Because even the kids can do it. And it just weakens Moshe's position. And the movie captures it by having Paro's son go over to, right, Ramsey's son go over to Moshe and kick the stick. Right? And everyone just laughs and he walks out shamefaced. When you watch the movie, the question that Tanakh doesn't actually ask you, you're forced to ask, which is, why did God set up Moshe to fail miserably and enable Paro to dig his heels into the ground? Right? You don't think about that in the text, but when you watch it, you realize that it's not just that he failed. This was a way of making Paro more obstinate. Right? And then you have to ask yourself why. Well, when you see it, the question, it just begs the question. You see it, right? You know that that's what's going on, that God did this on purpose. He wanted Moshe to fail. And then you wonder, right, why is that? So that's a shear for another time. But it could be that's what Vaichbar et libo means. Right? He's hardening his heart. He's not actually hardening his heart. What he's doing is, if you start off by making a few miracles that are easily replicated, what happens when you get to the point where they're not replicated?
Then we can see it's the finger of God.
So one of two possibilities. Either, right, so this is the two possibilities. For Paro, it allows him an excuse to say, he's just a better magician. Right? Or it allows education, because once you can't replicate it, you realize it's Elohim. Both of those are possible, and that's actually the difference in the reaction between Paro and the Chartumim. That Paro is never convinced it's God, and the Chartumim, when they can no longer replicate it, become convinced Es Belokim. The reason both of those reactions happen is because he was set up to fail. Right? Setting up to fail draws the Chartumim in, and once they're in, they learn their lesson, but it also allows Paro to dig his heels in because he can convince himself it's all magic. Right? You, when you watch it, right, you realize what's happening in a way that you don't when you, at least I don't, when I read the text, I'm not so visual. Right? So, you're right. I'm not opposed to watching the Ten Commandments. I think it actually is helpful if, as I said here, you try to use the movies of getting in the mindset of understanding what is it doing. Right there, it's more direct. Right, what is it actually saying about the text? What did I miss in the text when I just read the words and I didn't imagine what it would look like? Okay, I'm going to end. I'm going to stick around.